Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Unlimited Realities. I am your host, Lisa Zimmer, and I had prepared a fabulous show for you. I really have been so excited to provide a wonderful healing show today, a healing show focused upon racial justice, racial healing, to bridge gaps, to create unity. And during the month of our history, of our needs to be seen as a people, as a culture, as one, I really wanted to bring together two incredible women, one who is doing a documentary, and that is called Imaginary Walls, and it is going to be out this summer in 2019, and it is also an incredible documentary that offers us a look at what race and racial issues look like in America in the 21st century. But it also puts a lot of focus upon people who are healing racism. And so, although I do not have the producer today of Imaginary Walls, she called in sick this morning with a cold, so I'm going to be improvising last minute here. However, that gives us a whole lot more time to talk with my second guest, my author that's coming on our show today, author Kara Meredith, who wrote The Color of Life, A Journey Toward Love and Racial Justice. But before we chat with Kara, I do want to bring attention to one couple who are doing incredible healing work to heal racism. And this couple, they're featured in the documentary films, like I was telling you, Imaginary Walls, which again debuts the summer 2019. These are two of several people featured in the movie, documentary Imaginary Walls. This couple lives and hails in Oakland, California. They're known as Kokomon and Ashia Kladi from Oakland, California, and they've created a center called Attitudinal Healing Connection. So they offer a place where diverse groups of people gather to discuss their experiences and feelings about race, about what they've experienced in being of a different color or maybe married to a different color than themselves. And Kokomon and Ashia provide not only a safe place, but their open-mindedness, there's a non-judgmental environment. It's a place where there's healing and there's talk and embrace and unity. They stress that race is a construct of an ill society, a mass delusion, and that nobody should feel guilt or shame about what they've done or what they've felt in the past, because all of that, they believe, can be released, let go, and the participants can move forward in their lives. Imaginary Walls film, it explores this racial healing process and why it has worked for so many people, both here in the United States and in other healing centers. Ashia and Kokomon have helped form and found in both Asia, Africa, Mexico, South America, and they look closely at the success of the healing racial circles that they've provided, where they explore the personal life journeys and Ashia and Kokomon's life story and journey is woven into this film as intimate portraits of who they are and how they met later in life and what drew them to this work really shows the synchronicity of soul and spirit working in harmony to create unity in our world and to create a bridge to all the gaps that we see right now. So I want to highlight this film because I feel like this film is such a powerful opening in our awakening, in our communication as an evolving species, both on planet Earth and here in the United States of America. So without further ado, I do want to introduce my next guest, who we're going to spend the hour talking to in great detail about her wonderful, incredible book that she wrote, The Color of Life. And the author I'm talking about is the one and only Kara Meredith. And this is going to be such a one. First of all, I want to bring you to her book, again, A Color of Life. And this is a journey toward love and racial justice, but it's also a journey of her, it's her experience, it's her memoir, and it's what she has experienced by falling in love, being a white woman, and marrying a black man, and then having children, and how this has shown up in her life. So it's a very candid, very intimate conversation we're going to have right now, and I want to bring all of you to the attention of my guest, Kara Meredith. Kara, thank you so much for being on Unlimited Realities today. I absolutely loved your book.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's so great to be here with you, and thank you for your kind words.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you today. I have your book just really pulls you in. You are a wonderful storyteller, but you tell a story in a way that teaches us so much without teaching us in a way that we know we're being taught. And for me, that's a genius master teacher. So congratulations on being such a wonderful teacher to all of us in your book, on showing us not only how ignorant we can be unknowingly and not meaning to be, but how we all need to be a little bit more educated in how we communicate with one another, to the sensitivities of what has existed in our history. So I want to dig in, but I want to start from the very beginning, because in loving your story, Kara, you tell it in such a way that it's just a beautiful love story. And it's not only a beautiful love story, but it weaves so many lessons in there. So here you are, tooling around life, just graduated from and you are raised in a very suburban, conservative, white bread culture, really not knowing much about civil rights or anything, and certainly not the civil rights movement, which you weren't born during. So you decide, I'm for love. So you go to eHarmony. And who do you meet? You not only meet the man of your dreams, but the son of civil rights leader James Meredith. So let's go to that little piece of your life, the first beginnings of how life is starting, and you're opening up yourself to this new relationship, and you find out that this man you're starting to fall in love with brings you to this history book where his father is and walked in the Freedom March in 1966 with Martin Luther King. And here you are sitting with this man's son. I mean, that had to be surreal in itself. That absolutely had to, like, take the wind right out of you. How did you feel about that? Where did that bring you? What thoughts were going through your mind at this time?
Yeah, well, absolutely. So one clarification, which is maybe even worse, is that this was not right after college. I was 30 years old. I had had a little bit of life experience, so to speak. But, you know, he and I were older. So that's one of those that even though there were rumblings, so to speak, of coming to terms with my own racial identity, with racial injustice in the world around me and everything else. I mean, I was not 22. I was 30. So,
right.
That's my mistake. Oh, wow.
I looked at you as having, you know, your degree in theology and taking your time.
Totally.
And so my apologies, my time frame was wrong.
Well, no. Well, I mean, I think that's part of it too, where, you know, part of, I go, oh, wow, that was an even bigger chunk of life of not knowing and of ignorance. You know what I mean? So, where we were, James and I, we met, so to speak, via eHarmony in September, and probably a month later in October, we were what some might call fast and furious, but I think we had 11 dates in 14 days. We were rather certain with one another, but on the third date, he and I sat down. We were at his apartment, and he sat me down, and Marcus Miller, this amazing bassist, is playing in the background. We're sharing a bottle of Pinot Noir, the same bottle that we had shared on our first just a few days earlier. And he says, "I have something I want to show you." And he brings over to the coffee table this stack of photography books, and not scrapbooks, but legitimate, like, historical photography books from the civil rights movement. And he opens to one page in particular, and like you were telling the story as well, he opens to this earmarked page that he had obviously shown other people before. And there's a picture of Martin Luther King Jr. and a couple other men walking beside him. And he says to me, he points to the picture and he says, "This is my dad." And I look at it and I go, "Your dad is Martin Luther King?" You know, I'm just sitting there. I'm like, oh my God, what is going on?
Right.
And he goes, "No, this is my dad." And he points to the man right next to him. And so, Lisa, in answer to your question, it was, I felt equal parts awe. I felt equal parts ignorant. It's just this flood of emotions. I felt humiliated in a sense, because I had absolutely no clue who his dad was. And James Meredith is most known historically. In 1962, he was the first Black man or African-American man to integrate into the University of Mississippi, which was a huge event. I talk about it quite a bit in my book, but I mean, it involved federal intervention, 30,000 National Guard troops, among a host of other troops that were coming in. They called it the Second Civil War. It happened nearly 100 years after the end of the First Civil War. But it was one of those that was what he was first most known for. And then 4 years later, that's when he and King intersected a little bit more. They knew who each other were. They had intersected. But 1966, he set out for the Meredith March Against Fear. And it was it was intended to be a single man's walk against the Black fear when it came to voting rights. So in the state of Mississippi, where he still lives, he's still alive today, there was a lot of fear at that point in time around African Americans registering to vote. So he said, "I'm going to protest this fear." So he set out to march and to walk for 30 days through the state of Mississippi. And on the second day, he was shot. And because of that, that's what then led King and Stokely Carmichael, who birthed the Black Power Movement, and a host of other leaders to come in and to walk for him. So that's what that picture was.
Okay.
And that's where I had absolutely no clue. And I'm sure that I learned about the man who would later become my father-in-law in history classes and even in education classes. I was an education undergrad. But at that moment, as a 30-year-old woman, I had no clue who he was.
Incredible. So, you know, and to give you, some apology on that. I mean, honestly, as another white educated woman in America, I cannot tell you that there's been a whole lot of education in my education about the civil rights movement or Meredith. So I would totally understand you feeling ignorant. If, you know, I could myself claim ignorance to that. If it was called on me at 30 years old, I'd have to go Google it. You know,
okay.
I mean, I would have to be one of the things I would need to go do a lot of research on.
Okay.
Sure, I may have heard the name, but it wasn't enough to implant the powerful impression of
mm-hmm.
what he did, what he created, mm-hmm. that he was the first man to graduate from the University of Mississippi. I mean, it was an incredible time in history. It really, really was.
Yeah.
And, you know, your understanding as growing up as a, you know, a white girl, white woman in, you know, white America, I mean, in that piece, did you have any understanding of what white privilege was? Did you know and understand that you experienced that or what that was?
To be quite honest, I really don't think I did at that point. It was one of those. I was raised in an environment, and you talked a little bit about this, but I was raised in an environment in which we didn't believe that privilege was a thing. You know, my father, whom I love dearly, and I'm still in relationship with, he gave me permission to say everything that I said in the book, in which he does speak candidly about his experience or his beliefs around white privilege. But that was the environment in which I was raised. And so I was raised with a belief system that, you know, we didn't have a lot of money, that life hadn't been handed to us on a golden platter. And so how then could privilege even be a thing? So when it came
right.
to just the entire idea of white privilege, no, I had no clue. And really, again, like I said, even though there were rumblings, because I think there's rumblings in every single one of our stories, and there were so many rumblings throughout my 20s of beginning to notice and appreciate and celebrate diversity in the world around me. But as far as taking that to another level and saying, okay, and also I've benefited from and contributed to a world that benefits people who look like me, that I didn't understand or have any knowledge or grasp of.
Sure, sure. And at the same point, you had written in your book that your own father had been passed over for jobs that
mm-hmm.
were given to black people. So it was like he had the
mm-hmm.
reverse of that experience.
Yeah.
So I understand, you know, his confusion as well, and that's why this book is such a wonderful book to open up dialogue and conversation on, because there's so many different aspects and perspectives and experiences as we embrace our unity.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting navigation. It really is. It's very complex, and it's one of those pieces that at times it feels very, you know, irreparable, because
mm-hmm.
we go through these births in America that don't really show us, you know, provide too much faith in
mm-hmm.
An evolution or a thought process. So
mm-hmm.
one part of your book that I thought was it really impacted me. It really took me back, and I have to give Uncle Arthur a lot of credit for this.
mm-hmm.
Because Uncle Arthur asked you a question and articulated it in such a way that I think was so beautiful and so true and honest that I think people need to understand where that comes from. And it starts with you being the first woman, the first white woman to marry into this family. And
mm-hmm.
he made a statement that said, your white skin didn't matter, but the ignorance that sometimes accompanies whiteness did.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought
yeah.
that was a genius statement, because
mm-hmm.
that really spells a lot in regard to all of us. You know, of course there's pain. Of course
mm-hmm.
there is, you know, of course there is. And of course there are things that we've done wrong. Of course there is.
Yeah.
So, you know, that ignorance is really looked at in a way where he's giving you a pass. He's giving you compassion. He's saying, look, you know, I'm not blaming you, but, you know. And I thought, what a wonderful way to let you know, hey, the truth of the matter is you're not black, and we do are embracing you into our family. This is the truth.
I thought
that was really beautiful honesty. I really did. How did that hit you? How did you feel when he said that?
I think that was, again, one of those moments that stuck out in my mind forever. Obviously, it made its way into the book. So I had to remember it at some point. But that interaction happened. James and I think we were engaged just a couple of weeks later. So that happened while we were still dating. We were serious. We had already looked at rings by that point. But that was during my first trip to Mississippi. So it was meeting the family. It was being around all of them. And one of our big questions that both of us had, I wondered, you know, what would it be like for me to be the first white woman to marry into the family? And I wondered for him, what would it be like for him to be the first black man to marry into my family, on the other hand? And so we were sitting there in the backyard. It was Uncle Arthur and his wife and my mother-in-law and James and myself. And the interesting thing is that the question on my part or on James's part was never asked. So neither one of us ever said, hey, is the Meredith family going to be okay if Kara joins it? No one asked that question, but somehow Uncle Arthur intuitively sensed it. And so again, like you said, if it's okay, I'm just going to read this paragraph, but he said, you know, it's not so much about you, a white woman, entering this family, but it's about you realizing the impact one man's father had on the world. His fingers pointed first toward me and then toward the man I loved before continuing. Arthur's pride in and esteem for his brother's accomplishments were obvious, but was I willing to understand the impact? Was I willing to do the hard work and dig into the story that might someday be my own? So in a sense, it was an invitation, right? It was an invitation to do the hard work and to begin the journey, which I think is what it is, what it should be for every single one of us. Because for me, as someone who identifies as white, as a European American, the privilege has been that I haven't, for a long time, I haven't had to do the work because I didn't think the issues of race had anything to do with me. And yet, it doesn't matter whether you marry someone who has a different color skin than you. It doesn't matter if you have children, whether your children identify as white or as children of color. What matters is that every single one of us does the hard work that we're supposed to do, and that every single one of us embraces this conversation, because that's ultimately how healing and justice and reconciliation is going to come to our country, right?
Exactly. And you took this on, you know, when you took, and I loved, it says so much about you as a your soul, your beautiful soul, but you wrote about, and I think that this is, you know, this should be taught, like, before people get married. But you wrote about how when you were thinking about the pains and the hurt and the abuses that your husband experienced, you had to feel it. You had to take it on and look at it as, you know, although, okay, you may not be able to totally feel and experience it because you are a white woman and you didn't experience it, but you can go into that experience and understand the emotional rejection, abandonment, pain, you know, detachment must have felt. And I found that just such a beautiful sentiment to your marriage, because you embodied the wholeness of what marriage is, not only in your partner, but in the beauty and the pain and the what made him him, what brought him to who he is. And, you know, that gives you just such a an incredible light to shine upon this subject and for others to absorb it and receive it, because you're coming from that place of looking at the whole picture and without judgment, but you're looking at how we all have are changing or should be changing or are evolving. And let's talk a little bit about your father-in-law has so much wisdom spread throughout this book. And, of course, a wise soul without saying, definitely a man who has made a mark on this world. And your father-in-law tells you a simple question, and it asks, who in America enjoys the rights of a full citizenship? How does that question inform your approach to raising your mixed-race sons and to racial justice in general?
Absolutely. Well, yeah, there's several scenes, obviously, with my father-in-law. I mean, there's several scenes with lots of different people. But, you know, if James is my James, they're both named James, but if my James is a co-star, our children would soon then be after, at least in the latter half of the book. But then both of our fathers have several scenes with them as well. And so I think the scene you're speaking of took place when I was on a trip to Mississippi by myself. Is that the one you're speaking of?
When your father-in-law actually asked the question outward, and he even wrote to the president after he graduated from high school, and he says, am I a citizen?
Yeah.
And who in America enjoys the rights of a full citizenship?
Mm-hmm.
And how does that question, how do you inform, you know, raising your sons with that in regard to understanding, you know, their place and how, you know, where they are?
Yeah. No, thanks for the clarification. Yeah. I mean, it's a fascinating account. So, so listeners, go dive into everything that went on to his integration into the University of Mississippi in 62, because it was not just something that happened overnight, but it was a year and a half long process of essentially pitting the state of Mississippi against the federal government. That being said, when it comes to the present day, and I don't think I would have realized this had I don't know, married a white man and had white children, but because our stories have intersected and the power of love helped me see color, I've realized how much, at least statistically speaking, the systems that exist in our country today are still not set up to help young children of color succeed, and in particular, children who have black and brown skin. And so whether we go and reread an entire book or set of articles from someone like Michelle Alexander, who writes about the new Jim Crow, who wrote the book, The New Jim Crow, but essentially is talking so much about modern day slavery that exists not with the chains and shackles that happened 150 years ago, but instead in the school to prison pipeline, I see the statistics that are still real, that are still present. I've told this story a bit. We were in Seattle up until about 6 months ago. We're now down in the San Francisco Bay Area. So the documentary you were speaking of earlier, that is happening in our town in the same neck of the woods.
How incredible.
Yeah, yeah. So I would love
the irony. I should have grabbed that couple to talk on the show.
Oh, absolutely. And hopefully they will be able to. I mean, that would be an incredible follow up. Hopefully they will be able to come.
I would love that.
So, and side note, I would love to connect with that producer and with those folks. So, we can do that.
Okay, let's do that. Let's do that.
Absolutely. But you know, one statistic, and this is not this is not me saying Seattle is bad, because we see this in every single town, in every single city across the United States. But one statistic I've shared is that had our oldest son gone to the kindergarten gone to the public school, gone to kindergarten at the public school that he was slated to go to in Seattle, Washington. Had we stayed up there 6 months ago, there was a statistic I read about that school, which was considered a good school, you know, probably an 8 out of 10 or a 9 out of 10 on the rating. But
okay.
Of that, in school suspensions, you can go if you kind of dig, and you can dig into different school websites. 96% of in-school suspensions were made up of 7% of the student body, or came from 7% of the student body. And that 7% entirely either African-American or mixed-race children. And I remember reading
wow.
that and seeing that and just crying, bawling,
right.
going, my child
right.
is that 7%. My sons, I have
sure.
two mixed-race sons, my sons will automatically be put into that group. They are the 7%, which has become the 96%. And so when we talk about systemic injustice, that is an example that something in our school systems, and I would go so far as to not just say school systems, but I do a lot
right.
of work in the spiritual realm, so I would say it's the same in churches, you know, in religious or spiritual systems, but in which something is happening there that is not benefiting every single one of our children, and therefore every single life. So
right.
that is an example
right.
of what my father-in-law said in 1962, and I can't now do the math. I'm sitting here going, okay, that would be almost 70 years ago, right? That would be
56 years ago.
I was a high school English teacher, not a math major. But that's where I go. Until we don't have to talk about this, we have to keep talking about this. We have to keep having these conversations until we don't have to have the conversation anymore.
And, you know, these places that are coming, I mean, we have these little pockets of hope, like the wall,
mm-hmm.
like the imaginary wall film, like your book. We have people starting to talk about racism in a way that opens up dialogue, that opens up a forum of healing, that opens
mm-hmm.
up people where it doesn't place one against the other or on different sides of the fence. Sure, it certainly does still exist, unfortunately, but luckily
mm-hmm.
we have these pockets of hope. Now,
mm.
So you're very candid in your book about areas of your life being a white woman, and I don't mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, we're a culture that objectifies. I'm sorry. We just are, okay?
Sure.
And
yeah,
so
yeah.
as I'm objectifying even you by calling you a white
mm-hmm.
woman,
mm-hmm.
I want to
mm-hmm.
talk about your candidness in the book about
mm-hmm.
how you felt about certain things, because as I'm reading it, I'm thinking, oh, you poor thing, how you must, you know, I mean, sure, I would have been oblivious to, you know, objectifying as well, or certain aspects as well that you also went through, like choosing Ebony and Ivory as your wedding song and then
sure.
feeling like that wasn't right. I mean, why don't you feel that was right? Let's talk about that, because first off, I feel, you know, on the front of my brain, I think, oh, what a beautiful
mm.
song to pick for
sure.
And then as I'm thinking about it, I'm thinking, okay, so apparently that offended. So let's talk about how that offended. Where does the offense come in with that song being picked for your wedding song as you, a white woman, and your husband, a black man?
Absolutely. You know, that, well, to be totally honest, / continue in the candid thread, my husband didn't want that song because he didn't feel like it was a good dance song.
Okay.
So that was kind of James's thing. I mean, we try to have family dance parties every single night. With our family, it's our favorite. But you know, part of it for me, a big part of my journey, and I would say this is a big part of our journey, especially for those of us who are just stepping into conversations of race, no matter how we identify racially or ethnically or culturally. But I continue to just see things from the outside. And so there are several instances in the book in which I'm just seeing the outer layer. I'm just seeing the icing on the cake. And I'm thinking in seeing that, that somehow that seeing is solving the problems of the world. I'm thinking that by James and I being an interracial couple, that somehow that'll just break down walls of injustice, that that our love, because of what we look like on the outside, will somehow magically help people heal. So but
of course,
it's one of those that sometimes the outside doesn't help, and sometimes the assumptions that we make that aren't actually digging into the problem, those aren't actually helping the problem. So that song was somewhat of an example, but more so would have been when I started writing. And I, you know, with all good intentions, because I was kind of the queen of good and moral intentions, I thought, oh,
sure,
I'll name my husband. I'll give him an online moniker called the HBH, Hot Black Husband.
Right.
That would be even
right.
more an example of objectification. Then when I got pregnant and started writing about my kids, both to protect them but also to provide a little bit of humor, I called them my little Carmels. That
uh-huh.
would be an example of objectification. So, and those were later things, and I wrote about this in the book as well, but that I, you know, I realized this is not helping the conversation when I objectify my husband and my children and or any person with black or brown skin in this way, or anyone in general, when I'm objectifying and simply seeing someone by the outside of who they are and calling them and owning them as such, this is not helping. So I think that was part of my journey, was also making public apologies, was also publicly asking us. And as far as it then went, you know, I think maybe that's where we get to begin to see people. I mean, this is kind of kindergarten 101, right? But we get to again see people by who they are on the inside. And yes, we value and we respect the particularities of who they are, of their identity, sexually, of their gender, of their race and ethnicity and culture. But we also say, I don't need to label you by who you are on the outside from the get-go. I'll say this about, go ahead.
No, go ahead. You're on a roll.
I'll say this about my process. I said this about my process with the book, with writing, but this book has been a journey. I've been up and on writing it for 5 years. And a year ago, my first draft was due, and I didn't turn it in yet, but I printed it off and I gave it to writers. A lot of times authors will have what's called beta readers, which are early readers. They help give feedback. And so I finished it December, a little over a year ago, printed it off, gave it to probably 6 beta readers, a handful of both men and women, white folks, people of color. And I also printed one off for myself. And one of my beta readers, I'll never forget, she's a woman of color. And she said to me, she said, Kara, I don't think you notice that you're doing this, but every time you talk about someone who is white, you do not name them. You do not identify them by the outside of their skin. You make an assumption that they are white and that your reader knows that they are white. But every time, and so you don't even say that, but every time you talk about a person of color, you identify them by the outside of who they are. So, and she said, you can't do that. And you have to learn how to tell the story and to honor every individual. So, you know, by not objectifying them in that way, and also by not permeating permeating whiteness, so to speak. Because otherwise I was making an assumption of what's normal and of who's normal. So a lot of my rewrite included not necessarily saying or naming who people were by the outside of their skin, at least not initially. That was maybe something that came later if it was necessary, but it wasn't always usually necessary.
You know, it's interesting because as I was reading your book and as I'm talking to you now, it hits me many times that so much of this could have easily mm-hmm. been curtailed had we been raised with the proper respect and kindness for one another. Because, you know, I remember I wasn't raised in a racist household, but mm-hmm. in going back, and I was raised with the ignorance that was held by white people because they weren't mm-hmm. educated to the plight of black people. And so, you know, I grew up, I remember being 2 or 3 years old and hearing mm-hmm. the word colored people. And I was mm-hmm. so excited. I could not wait to meet these colored people. I thought that they had to be the most interesting, wonderful, beautiful colored people because that's what the I didn't know what I was hearing, you know? And I think to myself, so many ways we were raised with this ignorance that we have to be reeducated on a compassionate, kind level, but it was more out of ignorance rather than cruelty, you know? You know, there's this piece that I think being white families growing up in the 70s and the 80s, there was not a lot of communication about civil rights around the And so had there been, there would have been that education. There would have been the dialogue of, you know, objectifying about how to communicate, about respecting. And I find that's an interesting call because it's certainly just not something that you would normally give respect to unless you knew, you know? It's something should give respect to, but it's like you had to be taught that, you know, and she opened your eyes to that. And I find that such a powerful teaching that she gave you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, the interesting thing, I mean, just a little bit of history for your listeners. The interesting thing is that this colorblind rhetoric, that's what a lot of historians call it, but a colorblind rhetoric really was adopted in the 70s and 80s in school systems and in churches, especially alike, that in reaction to the civil rights movement and to all outward racism and prejudice, the school systems in particular adopted believing themselves colorblind and or adopted thinking that that was the way that they needed to operate. So they said, let's swing to the other side of the pendulum. Instead of being clear outwardly racist, we're going to be colorblind. And so with that, that's where, I mean, I was a child of the 80s. I have a scene in my book in which I remember our principal standing up at the front of the gymnasium for a school-wide assembly and all 600 students in the student body chanting along with him as he led us in a chant saying, "We are colorblind. We are colorblind." And I would think back to that. And again, all good intentions. Good intentions of the family in which I was raised. Good intentions of the school system. Good intentions of the church. All good intentions. But with
it's
that,
ironic.
I remember really thinking, what would it have been like to be a child of color? And yet, I just was talking to a good friend who identifies as black a couple days ago, and she said, well, I grew up with the same rhetoric. And she said, I grew up, and this is her story, and so I can't tell her story, but for her, she grew up with that same thing, and it wasn't until she was in high school that she began to wrestle with, well, what does it actually mean to not be colorblind and to see and to value color? But, you know, I think that's when it comes today, there was a study that I cite in my book, and this was also rewritten. There were so many drafts of this book, but for your readers who do, or your listeners who do end up ordering it, when you get a copy of the book, look at the very end, the notes section, because many of the longer notes that are in there, that was actually one of the first drafts. And my editors came back to me and they said, it is wonderful that you are trying to teach people all the things that you've learned and that they need to learn. But they said, number one, you're not an expert. You're a fellow sojourner. And so you have to approach it through a storytelling lens or you're going to lose people. And they said, number two, you're writing in too much of an academic voice. And so we're seeing your storytelling voice, which is so strong. And then you start to try and teach people and you go into academic voice. So all that to say, there was so much research that went into this book, but a lot of the endnotes were original to the book that we later took out and transformed into story. But the very first, this is what I was going to say, the very first note comes from a study from the book Nurture Shock, which was written 10 years ago, or published, 10 years ago. But the authors write that non-white parents are three times more likely to enter into conversations of race, while 75% of white parents never or almost never talk about race. So in that way, go back to what you were saying, it still is a problem. It still is something that every single one of us has to learn how to talk about. We have to learn how to talk about issues of justice, race, and privilege at our dinner tables, no matter whether we identify as a person of color or not. Every single one of us needs to start having these conversations. And a lot of us still don't know how to have these conversations.
No, they don't. And it's, that's why your book is opening up dialogue in a way that it makes people want to ask questions, and that's why I think everyone should read The Color of Life by Kara Meredith, audience. but, you go through this, when I read that part about colorblind, I must have bypassed that part of school because ours was just flat-out ignorance. Ignorance. Way that, hey, let's call it something and then be ignorant. I must have bypassed that part because I'm a little older than you. But you are definitely, it's hitting on a chord that I cannot imagine, one, because I'm white, but I cannot imagine what the children must have felt by, one, not being seen, and, two, not being valued by what they're being seen as. And to me, that's just, consequences that are astronomical, not only within the soul of the individual, but also passed on and passed down and, spread out in society. So, you're tapping on so much of what we've all grown up with, not knowing that we were so blind or so ignorant or so insensitive to so many things. And, it's important to have these things and these topics and these conversations brought up so that we can talk about the basics, because it's unfortunate that we have to learn the basics, but we do. We have to go back to, things that we should have been taught and learned in kindergarten. There's you were talking about, how in opening up our eyes and becoming more sensitive and becoming and opening up dialogue. Let's talk about some things that people of faith can do to address racial injustice. Are there some concrete ideas or things that you feel people who want to create a bridge can do to address racial injustice more?
Absolutely. I'm going to pull up an article that actually just went live last week, and I'll send this to you if there's show notes or if your listeners want to read more. But I just actually had published last week. What's that?
Wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah. I had an editor reach out and say, hey, would you please write an article about concrete actions people of faith can take to address racial injustice. So I will send this to you, but it's kind of exactly answering your question. The first thing, we tune our ears to hear. And I would say for all of these, it doesn't matter whether you identify as a person of faith or whether you don't. This is something for every single one of us, but we adjust our ears to hear my mantra, quite honestly, is to listen and learn and listen some more. And so for me in particular, and I think for all of us, but what does it mean to start listening to the stories that I haven't thought of mattered? What does it mean to listen to the stories of my brothers and sisters of color? What have I not heard because I haven't taken the time to listen in the first place? The second thing is to start doing our homework. Three of my favorite books to read when it comes to entering into these conversations, Just Mercy by Bryan Stevenson, The Color of Compromise by Jamar Tisby. If any of your listeners are in Jackson, Mississippi, Jamar and I are going to be doing an event together in April. So you can check out my website, karameredith.com/speaking for more information. And then for those people who do identify as white, one of my friends wrote a book a couple years ago called White Awake. His name, the author, is Daniel Hill. But it's a phenomenal book, especially for people of faith who want to start doing their homework. Number three, raise your awareness. So entering into conversations of racial justice means raising our awareness. I think for all of us, that means that we begin listening to the voices of those we haven't always heard. But, you know, most of us are on social media. So I would highly suggest going and making sure that you are following and listening to the voices of people of color, access websites created by racial and ethnic minorities, start watching some documentaries. We can pray for new eyes to see or meditate on having new eyes to see. But I often ask an audience, who are you not seeing? Because some people will say, well, I live in an all-white community. And I say, well, that is great, and I don't think you do. Who are you not seeing? Because you don't
right.
have to see them. Four last ones, we get proximate. Bryan Stevenson, the author of Just Mercy, he talks about this a ton, but he says we have to get proximate to the pain. And again, that's not necessarily about entering into an interracial marriage or about raising children of color, but what does it mean to get proximate, to truly enter into relationship with our brothers and sisters of color, so that we can begin to understand and empathize with their pain. The last three, to embrace holy lament. I think this is a huge one. This is where we recognize both on a personal but also on a systemic level the injustices that are present. Sometimes that means that we say sorry. Sometimes that means that we say sorry personally, but we also say sorry corporately. And the last two, we commit to the journey and then we repeat. So committing to the journey means not just embracing conversations of racial injustice or of learning about historical figures that are Black or African American during the month of February, but we commit to this around year-round. We say, okay, I'm going to commit to learning and growing. And then we do it all over again. So that's part of the article. I will send that to you
right
now.
Wonderful. That's wonderful. Thank you, Kara. I really appreciate that. That's, you know, there's so much that when we look outside of ourselves, we feel and see a little differently. And, you know, it really doesn't take that much of a tweaking our perspective to really, you know, gain a little bit deeper awareness of what our fellow brother is experiencing. And, you know, at this time in life and this time in our society, there's never been a greater time to heal the gaps that exist.
Mm-hmm.
And in coming back to your father-in-law, the wonderful James Meredith, he kept asking you a question. And I want to end our interview on this. He kept asking you, you know what I'm going to ask you. He kept asking you, why are you writing this book? And in your own frustrations of trying to answer this to the best of his acceptance, I loved your answers, by the way. Tell us. I mean, I I see the many reasons and the layers of why you wrote this book. It's a great, wonderful storytelling, healing book. I think that this is a conversation we need to have at our dinner tables. I think we need to teach our children how to love one another beyond what we look like, because there's so much beautiful diversity in our country, and it's happening so much more frequently, thank God, that we are looking at things so much differently. So coming back to your wonderful father-in-law, tell us, Kara, why did you write this book?
Yeah, well, that was the exact question that he kept asking me. This was on the trip that I mentioned. I flew out to Mississippi to interview my father-in-law, to spend some time with him and the family, just by myself, without my husband or the boys. And on our last day together, we were going and visiting all these different sites in Jackson that had been of historical significance to him and to the work that he had done, or the work that he is known for. But he kept asking over and over again. He said, "Why are you writing this book?" And I would say, "Well, because people are fascinated about the story of a white woman who married your son." And he would shake his head. I had gotten it wrong. "Why are you writing this book?" And I would say, what am I not saying here? And I would respond, because I have a story to tell. Because white people need to understand that issues of race have something to do with them too. Why are you writing this book? Because I want justice for my sons and for my black and brown brothers and sisters. And although all of those answers were good and noble and lovely, they weren't the answer that he was looking for. And the answer, I think, came later. And that was, I was writing this book entirely for me. And I was writing this book because I had to embrace and believe that justice and wholeness and peace were also for me. I was writing this because, yes, because of my brothers and sisters of color, but in realizing that wholeness and justice and peace, those are all the root of the same word, by the way. And so in realizing that that was mine, that I too am part of the beloved community, I can't help then but lay down my power and privilege. There's then something that happens when I have this realization that then I just want it for everyone else. So then that makes me fight. But I have to first realize that for myself. So that was the answer to the question. I was writing it for me. And I think that that's what it is for every single one of us. We are invited to the table. We are the beloved community. And when we realize that and recognize that, we also see who isn't there or who hasn't been given full benefits, and we want and desire that for them. So for me, I sit here and I go, wow, this, what an honor. My job now is just to have conversations about this conversation. With all the book tour stuff, we're not having Kara, the white lady, get up to read or talk about the book. But what we're doing is we are having me enter into conversations with friends of color. And it's a legitimate conversation in which we're each up there on stage and we're sharing our stories. Because this is how we begin to have healing and have, again, ultimately maybe have justice and reconciliation.
Oh, I love it. I love it. This has been such a wonderful hour. And honestly, I guess God, you know, knows what he's doing always, because we needed the hour.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to do, like you said, another show. I want to have the participants of the film, Imaginary Films, on. I want to talk to you again. We'll do a recap after your book tour, and we'll just revisit this and talk again about what conversations came up about the color of life. Kara, thank you so much for coming on today.
Yeah.
It has been a joy talking to you. I love your book. I think this is just a fabulous discussion, a fabulous book to open up eyes and hearts and discussions, and I wish you all the success and love in the world. Thank you so much for coming on, and I look forward to talking to you again. Where can my audience where can my audience find you on your website?
Absolutely. So my website is KaraMeredith.com. Otherwise, you can find me on Facebook and Instagram at Kara Meredith Wright, and I'm on Twitter at KaraMac54.
Wonderful. God bless you, Kara. God bless you and your beautiful family, and thank you so much for coming on Unlimited Realities today. Until next time, everybody, God bless you. Have a wonderful week. I look forward to talking to you next week. Thank you for tuning in. Have a very, very blessed Valentine's Day. Bye-bye.